The WNBA season is in full swing, and the league has more recently become known for its activism and as a place where athletes feel more comfortable being out as gay. And that move toward acceptance has had an impact on how the athletes present themselves off the court. It may seem small, but the evolution of fashion in the WNBA to include more androgynous and masculine looks marks an important change from what the league used to expect from its athletes. Brittany De La Creta is a sports writer focusing on the intersection of gender and sports. Thanks for being with us, Brittany.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about pregame looks in both the NBA and the WNBA. How long have those outfits been catching public attention before Instagram, if you will?
It's definitely been longer in the NBA, where they've almost been using the hallway like a runway, and now designers are, you know, debuting clothing on the NBA athletes and boosting sales that way. In terms of the WNBA, this is a newer thing that has definitely risen with social media, and especially this year, you've seen a major uptick in that, with teams dedicating specific hallways for taking these pregame photos, and some of them even making hallway murals as a backdrop for them.
You've done reporting on how there are a number of stars in the WNBA who are embracing less gender normative fashion and looks. Who are some of those athletes?
Courtney Williams with the Connecticut Sun is one. Brittany Sykes with the Atlanta Dream. Tamara Young, who's with the Las Vegas Aces, and she actually even has her own clothing line. That's just a few, but there are many, many on every team who are doing this.
And what kind of, how would you describe their looks?
I would say that gender presentation is on a spectrum, and when we think of typical traditional feminine looks, it might be heels, it might be dresses, it might be, you know, frilly items. And along the spectrum are more androgynous or gender neutral looks, and masculine of center and butch looks as well, which may include actual men's clothes or things like blazers and pants and sneakers. So it can fall really anywhere on that spectrum.
Now, how supportive has the WNBA been about those fashion choices?
Yeah, I feel like there has been this shift, particularly in more recent years, in which the WNBA has stopped trying to shoehorn its players into an image that doesn't necessarily fit who they are. And they did that for a very long time. And it's really only, I'd say, Lisa Borders, who was the president until last season. I feel like it was part of her legacy to really start to embrace the players for who they are and to let them be themselves, which really has brought a much more authentic connection, I think, between fans and players as well.
Let's talk a little bit about that history, because you've written about the fears that, or the unfounded fears, I should say, that playing sports could make women queer or more masculine. What impact did that have on women athletes in the past and what they were expected or allowed to wear?
Yeah, so this goes back to the turn of the 20th century, where they were afraid that women were too fragile to play sports or that playing sports would make them masculine. A lot of those fears were rooted in homophobia, worries that women who became too mannish would be unable to, you know, bear children, which was their seen as their purpose. And we can see, you know, in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League during World War II, made famous by the movie A League of Their Own, the players were forced to wear lipstick on the field. They had to play in skirts. They attended charm school. And these requirements were to make them both attractive to the, you know, men who might be watching and as non-threatening as possible. But those policies went deeper. It wasn't just because they wanted the women to appear feminine. It really was a fear of lesbianism that led to that. There was no fraternization policies as well between teammates because of that fear. And that continued, you know, in the WNBA's early history. I think they also tried to shoehorn their players into a more palatable, what they perceived as palatable image, which was rooted in traditional femininity. You know, in 2008, they had makeup classes for rookies, and those went on for several years, and they became optional in later years, but it was something that they asked players to do. And they even had, in the early aughts, there was a campaign they called This Is Who I Am, and to watch it now is pretty cringeworthy. There's shots of, like, Sue Bird, who's one of the best players to have ever played, like, in a bathing suit while holding a basketball. So, yeah, this history goes back a really long time.
I wonder if there, you mentioned the WNBA's previous makeup tutorials for rookies. Was there anything equivalent to how male athletes were expected to look, or were they ever trained on how to cut their hair or shave or any of those other things?
You know, I don't know. I know there's some baseball teams like the Yankees notoriously have a no facial hair policy. That's one that comes to mind. But I don't think it's ever been as extreme as we've seen in women's sports. And, you know, there's this perception or stereotype that all female athletes are gay, which is not true, but a lot of them are. And for a long time, there has been this effort to prevent them from being perceived as, you know, who they are.
And that fear is rooted in what? In the fact that they would turn off male viewers, or the fact that advertiser, what where's that fear rooted in?
A lot of things, that they would turn off the men who might be watching. I think, you know, filtered through the male gaze, which particularly sports has often been, the assumption being that the audience is male and that they wouldn't want to watch women just play sports, and that maybe the attraction might be the attractiveness of the athletes to, you know, a heterosexual male viewer. I think there was fear of losing money, or, you know, a lot of times this is driven by money. Who traditionally gets the endorsements and the marketing deals? Often that has been athletes who fit these very traditional ideas of feminine beauty, who are thin and blonde and white. So I think it's rooted in a lot of things. And also that, you know, queer women have bucked the system that, you know, revolves around patriarchy. And so there's also that as well, that they are somehow eschewing what they should be and who they should be for.
Several players on the U.S. women's soccer team have started their own clothing brands that feature a lot of gender-neutral pieces. Is that starting to become more of an option for female athletes, or are a lot of female athletes still looking to partner with bigger brands like Nike, who may not be as open to gender-neutral fashion?
I think what we're seeing is athletes creating the kind of clothes that they want to wear. And if they don't think it's available from a mainstream brand, that they're going to go out and create it themselves, you know, like Tamara Young with the WNBA. And I think what we're also seeing is, you know, you mentioned these are soccer players and we're talking about the WNBA. These two leagues have the most openly gay players, the most players who are out. And it is those players who are starting to push the boundaries of presentation, and I think moving their entire sport into a more accepting direction.
We're running out of time in the segment, but I do want to get in one question here. We're talking about fashions off the court, but what about the way women's fashions are being policed when they're playing the sport? And I think the most obvious example here is Serena Williams.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what should be at play is the comfort and what allows them to play their game the best, but unfortunately it's often been about how they look as much as how well they play. But that is starting to change, and I hope it does.
Well, we'll see if there are more cat suits on the way. Brittany De La Creta is a sports writer focusing on the intersection of gender and sports. Thank you so much, Brittany.
Thanks for having me.
And you've been telling us which athletes you admire for breaking the norms in fashion at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, my vote is for Billie Jean King. She didn't care how she looked, how she was perceived, and she took on John McEnroe and kicked his butt.
My name is Luke from San Jose, California. Always been inspired by Brandi Chastain, the soccer player, for celebrating in any way that any other male athlete would have done.
Hi, my name is Sharon, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. Serena Williams is inspirational. I think she stands up for herself really well in a world controlled by men.
Hello, my name is Scott from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'd like to highlight an athlete by the name of Zuby, who is a British powerlifter and musician who recently broke several British women's powerlifting records while identifying as a woman. She shows an admirable level of gender fluidity and is a great victory for both women's powerlifting and the transgender community.
Hi, this is Catherine calling from Brooklyn. One of my favorite female athletes is a polo player named Sue Sally Hale, who unfortunately passed away in 2003, but she did garner a New York Times obit, so you know how important she was. And she was so important because she first started playing polo disguised as a man, because in the 50s, women weren't allowed to play polo. But by the 70s, she was accepted out as a female riding horses, playing polo along with the men, and paved the way for many, many, many female polo players, including me.
Good stuff, everyone. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow.